Church steeples and factory buildings, they still spike Milwaukee's skyline, standing as symbols of two epic forces, industries and immigrants. I'm John Goethe. This time on The Making of Milwaukee, the rise of a blue-collar metropolis, how industries and immigrants spawn great prosperity, even greater problems, and then a radical solution as Milwaukee became the nation's only big city to trust its fate to the socialists.
Production of The Making of Milwaukee is made possible with grants from Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Halbert and Alice Kadish Fund, Paddock Fund, Lidke Smith Fund, Otto Borchard Family Fund, Catherine and Walter Lindsay Fund, Lined and Harry Bradley Foundation, Kepin Gerlach Foundation, Faye Macbeth Foundation, Northwestern Mutual Foundation, David and Julia Eline Charitable Foundation, We Energies, Joseph and Vera Zilber Foundation, Polybill Foundation, Douglas and Eleanor Seaman Trust, C.G. Schmidt, and by the MPTV Friends.
Your first view is probably from the freeway. Heading south on I-94, you see a pale brick church whose twin spires are capped with fading gold leaf. The landmark is named for St. Stanislaus, and it's the first Polish church in urban America.
St. Stan's made national history, but it also marked an important shift in Milwaukee's development. Although Germans were still dominant after the Civil War, more and more newcomers were arriving from Southern and Eastern Europe.
They came from Poland in particular, but also from Italy, Greece, Russia, and a host of other nations. Their region was rocked by economic troubles, political unrest, and for some groups, persecution. Mounting pressures made it prudent to leave. And the promise of industrial jobs in Milwaukee and other cities attracted new Americans by the millions. Polish immigrants were in the vanguard. By 1890, they were second only to Milwaukee's German population in size. One of their first concerns was to establish a Catholic church. In 1866, 30 Polish families started St. Stanislaus Parish in a tiny Southside chapel they bought from a group of Germans. 6 years later, with a population explosion underway, the congregation moved to its present home on Mitchell Street. Parish priests were soon baptizing a dozen babies every week. St. Stan's was the heart and soul of Milwaukee's largest Polish community. The South Side came to life as a densely settled neighborhood of workers' cottages, corner saloons, and family-run bakeries and butcher shops. Mitchell Street became its downtown, just as Third Street had for the German North Side. Known as the Polish Grand Avenue, Mitchell resembled the main street of a small city. But not all Polish immigrants were Southsiders. St. Hedwig's Church on Brady Street was the city's second Polish congregation, and it remains a prominent East Side landmark today. A third settlement was unique in America, Jones Island. Beginning in the 1870s, fishing families from the Baltic seacoast of Poland, the Kashubes, colonized the windswept peninsula at Milwaukee's front door. Joined by other Europeans, the Kashubes made Jones Island a regional center of commercial fishing. Setting their nets for trout, whitefish, perch, and herring, they brought home 2 million pounds in a good year. While their countrymen across the river took jobs in local industries, the islanders continued a way of life they had known for centuries in Europe. Jones Island was the closest thing to an urban village Milwaukee has ever known. Whether on the island or the mainland, one trait that set the Poles apart was their desire for homes of their own. The Milwaukee Sentinel noted the tendency in 1874.
Usually the first money they can call their own is put into the purchase of a lot, on which they mean to erect a house as soon as possible. They have a strong prejudice against paying rent.
The newest groups get the oldest houses. That's been the unwritten law in America's cities for generations. But the Poles broke that law. Instead of renting homes in hand-me-down neighborhoods close to downtown, they bought small lots on the city's edge and covered them with small cottages. But they didn't stop there. The next step was to convert the cottage to a Polish flat. When finances permitted, the immigrants jacked up their houses and bricked in half-basement living units beneath them. Single-family homes became duplexes almost overnight. The steep stairs and the ground-level windows are its hallmarks. But the flat had a psychological impact as well. Many Poles had not been of the landowning classes in Europe. By buying the little lot and putting up the little cottage, they became landowners. By converting it to a Polish flat, they became landlords as well. One result was a dramatic increase in density. My grandmother was raised in this house. Her father died of tuberculosis when she was just 9, leaving her mother to raise 6 kids on a washerwoman's wages. What saved the family from ruin was the fact that they owned 5 living units on this lot, 3 in the front house and 2 in the back. One, the smallest of course, was theirs. The other 4 were rented out. When my grandmother lived here, there were on this single narrow lot 27 kids, enough to field 3 baseball teams.
Polish flats tell one story about the immigrants. Catholic churches tell another. And the contrast in scale is often startling. St. Stanislaus was the mother parish of more than 20 Polish Catholic congregations, and their steeples stand as benchmarks in the community's outward expansion. The grandest church of them all is the Basilica of St. Josephat. In the late 1800s, St. Josephat was probably the largest congregation of any faith in Wisconsin. Nearly 12,000 people worshipped in the combination church and school on Lincoln Avenue, enough to fill a small city. In 1896, with the pews filled to overflowing, the parish broke ground for what is still the largest church in Milwaukee. Hoping to save money on building materials, the congregation bought the old Chicago post office and had it dismantled stone by stone. 500 flat cars were needed to bring all the salvage up to Milwaukee, and virtually everything was used, even the heavy brass doorknobs that still bear the government seal. Construction crews labored for 5 years. Thank you. When the church was finished in 1901, only one dome in the country was higher, and that was on the U.S. Capitol. St. Josephat's debt was just as enormous. The parish flirted with bankruptcy for nearly 10 years, and it took another 15 to pay off the last loan and finish work on the interior. But the results were stunning. In 1929, St. Josephat was declared a basilica, the equivalent of all-star status for a Catholic church. It remains the closest thing Wisconsin has to a European cathedral.
Building St. Josephat was a labor of love. The men of the parish helped dig the footings. The women carried dirt away in their aprons. Nearly one-third of the debt was owed to members who had taken out second mortgages on their homes and loaned the proceeds to the building fund. If other lenders had foreclosed, the immigrants would literally have lost the roofs over their heads. And so the real story of the Basilica is its people. Despite endless economic struggles, they raised a magnificent monument to faith and a towering statement of community. The majestic church and the modest homes were built by the same people. Decades later, the contrast in scale continues to astound.
Milwaukee was Europe once removed in the late 1800s. The city's German accent was pronounced, and the Irish maintain a strong Celtic presence in the heart of the city. The Third Ward, between the river and the lake, was their first neighborhood. As the Irish moved up, however, they also moved out, generally to the west. Merrill Park, west of 27th Street above the Menominee Valley, became their new stronghold. St. Rose Church was their spiritual home. The list of charter members reads like the Dublin phone book. The Milwaukee Road provided them with a living, either in the shops or on the trains. Merrill Park's heroes were the engineers who drove locomotives across the plains and over the mountains of the Great West. The Irish exodus from the Third Ward was hastened by a disastrous 1892 fire. Fanned by gale force winds, the blaze took several lives and left 2,000 people homeless. When the smoke cleared, the Third Ward entered a new phase as an Italian neighborhood. The Italians were part of the same surge of Southern and Eastern Europeans that brought the Poles to Milwaukee. They added their own flavor to an ethnic stew that was growing richer every year. The great wave of Italian immigration began in the 1890s. Most of the newcomers were from Sicily, an island as poor as it was beautiful. They worked with their backs and hands, but some Sicilians entered the street trades, particularly the fresh fruit and vegetable business. Beginning with small pushcart operations, several families opened wholesale houses on the Third Ward's Broadway, a street better known as Commission Row. The community's anchor was just three blocks away, Madonna di Pompei, known to generations of Milwaukeeans as the Little Pink Church. Our Lady of Pompeii was the focal point of elaborate festivals held several times each summer. Food, fireworks, and solemn processions attracted virtually everyone in the community. The tradition continues today as Festa Italiana, the oldest and for many years the largest of Milwaukee's lakefront ethnic festivals. Proceeds from Festa made the Italian Community Center possible. Located in the Third Ward, the center is literally a homecoming. The first Greek immigrants arrived on the same wave as the Italians. Most were bachelors who took entry-level jobs in local industries. Others opened tobacco shops, restaurants, and other small businesses. Their dream was to make money in America, return in triumph to Greece, and live out their lives in comfort. Most discovered that their exile was permanent. One immigrant told the story of a short-order cook who rented an apartment from his family.
This man, our tenant, had come over here with the same idea as the others, to make money and go back. He had two daughters who were babies in Greece. When he would get ready to go back, he would buy a couple pair of shoes for a 2- and 3-year-old. Well, something would happen and he would stay. But the following year, he would buy shoes for a 3- and 4-year-old. Something would happen again and he would stay. This went on for years. The girls were in their 20s when he brought them to this country. When we finally cleaned out his apartment, there was a big trunk full of shoes.
A new church signified the community's permanence. The bachelors organized Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church in 1906 and later built an ornate Byzantine church on Broadway. It became a haven for families in joy and in sorrow. Funeral photographs were a way to share grief with relatives in the old country. In 1961, Annunciation moved to a new home on 92nd Street. Its architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. Eastern European Jews built a distinctive community of their own. Thousands came from Russia, Ukraine, Lithuania, and Poland, settling near the heart of Old Kilbourn Town on the west side of the river. There they organized at least 7 synagogues at the turn of the century, all of them Orthodox. They also took advantage of programs at the Milwaukee Jewish Settlement, which offered English classes, athletics, literary circles, children's clubs, discussion groups, and a Sabbath school. The settlement's services included cooking classes taught by the legendary Lizzie Kander. In 1901, she published her favorite recipes in a user-friendly guide she called the Settlement Cookbook. 2 million copies, and many revisions later, it's still an American standard. A young girl named Goldie Mabuez was typical of the Jewish immigrants. She was 8 years old when her family moved into an apartment on Walnut Street. Goldie found Milwaukee spellbinding, especially the Third Street shopping district near her home.
I was delighted by my pretty new clothes, by the soda pop and ice cream, by the excitement of being in a real skyscraper, the first 5-story building I'd ever seen. In general, I thought Milwaukee was wonderful. Everything looked so colorful and fresh, as though it had just been created. And I stood for hours staring at the traffic and the people. I spent the first days in Milwaukee in a kind of trance.
Goldie was first in her class at the 4th Street School. And she continued her education at Milwaukee's State Teachers College, now part of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Years later, as Prime Minister of Israel, Golda Meir became perhaps the most famous ex-Milwaukeean in the world. Other groups made their mark on Milwaukee while Golda was growing up. Many were from the Slavic countries of Eastern Europe, a family of nations that stretched from Poland in the north to the former Yugoslavia in the south. Poles were the largest contingent of Slavs, but there were several other groups. Slovaks settled in the Kilbourn Town area at first, and then planted another community in Pigsville, a unique West Side neighborhood named for an early pig farm. Croatian immigrants, like the Slovaks, were heavily Catholic. The heart of their community was Sacred Heart Church on the near north side. Walker's Point, with its abundance of industrial jobs, had particular attraction for Slavic immigrants. Slovenes, and a smaller number of Croats, worshipped at Holy Trinity Catholic Church on South 4th Street, an old German parish. Serbs built a small Orthodox church, St. Sava's, practically across the street. After World War II, St. Sava's parish erected a striking Byzantine cathedral on the southwest side, right next to a legendary Milwaukee gathering place, Serb Hall. Walker's Point was a neighborhood of nations, and that heritage is preserved in its churches. Greeks, Bulgarians, and Ukrainians joined the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes in Walker's Point, and earlier groups, Germans, Norwegians, Czechs, and the Irish were present as well. There might have been a dozen different languages spoken in a single block. The fruit of all this diversity, many years later, is the greatest concentration of historic churches in Wisconsin, perhaps in the entire Midwest. The near south side skyline is practically a thicket of steeples.
The churches of Walker's Point reflected a fundamental fact about Milwaukee. It was Europe once removed. In 1890, immigrants and their children made up 86% of the city's population. That was the highest proportion in America. The national average was only 33%. Milwaukee was emphatically a city of immigrants. But there was another side to the coin. Milwaukee remained a city of industries as well. The growth of its ethnic groups reflected the growth of its economy. By the late 1800s, changes in the industrial world had created new prosperity, and with that prosperity, new problems. Milwaukee moved to a different music in the late 1800s. The city still tanned hides and butchered hogs, but its tune changed from processing to manufacturing. Products of the earth gave way to products of steel, especially machinery. Metal bending became a way of life, and by 1900, Milwaukee was the self-proclaimed machine shop of the world. Corporation tells the story in a nutshell, or at least a gearbox. Falk is the largest manufacturer of precision industrial gears in America, but its roots go back to a 19th century brewery.
Franz Falk, the German immigrant we met earlier, was one of Milwaukee's pioneer brewers. His Menominee Valley plant was among the city's largest, and it flourished until 1892, when a pair of disastrous fires convinced his family to sell out to the Pabst Company. Falk's older sons took jobs with Pabst. Hermann, one of the youngest, chose a different direction, he opened a small machine shop in a corner of the old brewery and began to tinker. Herman's first success was a foundry on wheels, a device used to weld streetcar tracks together in place. From there, he got into gears, becoming a major manufacturer of gears used in mines, steel mills, ships, and a host of other applications. It was Falk Gears that opened and closed the lock gates on the Panama Canal. As the business grew, Herman Falk built, on land his father had purchased in the 1850s, one of the largest factories in the Menominee Valley. That plant, much enlarged, is still in business today, and it symbolizes the larger shift in Milwaukee's economy. The Falk family moved from beer to gears, from malt to machinery in a single generation. Milwaukee attracted a host of other tinkerers who began with small shops and large dreams. Henry Harnischfeger was one of them. Born in Germany, he was a master mechanic who got tired of working for others. In 1884, Harnischfeger and his partner, Alonzo Pauling, opened a small machine shop in the Walker's Point neighborhood. It was so flimsy that snow blew in through the cracks in the siding, and tools froze to the partner's hands each winter morning. But Pauling and Harnischfeger did excellent work. They attracted customers like Bruno Nordberg and Christopher LaValle. Both men graduated to shops of their own in the Walker's Point neighborhood. Nordberg eventually became a world leader in mine hoists and diesel engines. LaValle made a full line of construction machinery driven by endless chains of metal links. He called his firm the Chain Belt Company. Pauling and Harnischfeger soon developed product lines of their own. Traveling overhead cranes became their specialty, and no one in the world made more. Walker's Point prospered as Milwaukee's industrial incubator. Dozens of small shops planted there sprouted into gigantic enterprises, and not all were started by immigrants. Henry Harnischfeger's neighbors included A.O. Smith, whose family ran a bicycle factory. In 1899, Smith built America's first pressed steel automobile frame in that shop. He would ultimately become the nation's largest maker of car frames. A few blocks away, Edward Kearney and Theodore Trecker started a small shop whose specialty was machine tools. Kearney and Trecker would become one of the most trusted names in industry. Just down the block from Harnischfeger, brothers Lind and Harry Bradley experimented with new ways to control electric motors. Dr. Stanton Allen, a family friend, invested $1,000 in the Bradley's dream. After a long series of technical failures and financial setbacks, the device was perfected, and Allen Bradley became the last word in industrial motor control. The largest industry in Walker's Point was also the oldest, Edward P. Allis's Reliance Works. In the late 1800s, his plant made the largest steam engines in the world. When the original Allis complex was filled to capacity, the firm bought land to expand just west of Milwaukee. The site was called, naturally, West Allis. The company gave birth to a new suburb, and it acquired a new name in a 1901 merger, Allis Chalmers. Growing with West Allis, Allis Chalmers became one of the leading manufacturers of heavy machinery on Earth. On the other side of town, an American legend was born. In about 1901, two benchmates at a Milwaukee bicycle factory began to discuss ideas for a motorized cycle. Their names were William Harley and Arthur Davidson. Two more Davidsons joined the effort, and in 1903, their father, a cabinet maker by trade, built them a 10 by 15 foot wooden shed behind the family home on the west side. The quartet eventually moved downhill to the plant that is still Harley Davidson's headquarters. By 1917, they were turning out 18,000 motorcycles a year. Milwaukee has been a mecca for motorcycle lovers ever since. Regular reunions draw tens of thousands of fans, all coming to pay homage to the bike that made Milwaukee famous. Motors, machinery, and metal bending signified a new economic order for the city. Even as manufacturing took over, however, Milwaukee's best-known industry continued to grow. In 1890, in fact, for the first and only time in the city's history, beer was Milwaukee's most important product. Pabst remained the dominant brewer, and a Pabst ad described beer as the ideal tonic for harried moderns.
As old companies prospered and new ones multiplied, industry developed an unshakable grip on Milwaukee. By 1910, 57% of the city's adult males were industrial workers. That was the second highest concentration in America. Only Detroit, the nation's emerging automotive center, had a higher proportion. But prosperous industries did not mean prosperous workers.
Tens of thousands endured conditions we'd consider criminal today. Leather tanners had some of the foulest smelling jobs in America. Iron workers had some of the hottest. Bayview's mill hands faced temperatures of 160 degrees or more. Packing plant workers spent their days up to their elbows in hog entrails. Machine operators worked within inches of open belt drives that were a constant hazard to life and limb. Children often had full-time jobs by the age of 12. And that wasn't all. As long as immigrants flooded the labor market, employers held all the cards. Industrial workers of the 1880s put in 10 to 12 hour days, 6 days a week, with no thought of vacations and not a dime in fringe benefits. For all the perils, for all the aggravations, workers on the lowest and widest rungs of the ladder could expect to earn no more than $1.25 a day. That translates to a little over $2 an hour in modern terms, without benefits. Workers did not accept their plight without protest. Organized labor established a foothold even before Milwaukee became a city. And a variety of trade unions were formed over the decades. But Milwaukee workers lacked a single organization that was open to everyone, and a single issue that could stir them all to united action. That organization was the Knights of Labor, and that issue was the 8-hour day. The Knights were organized among Philadelphia garment workers in 1869, but they soon became an inclusive national union. The group's stated goal was to secure to the workers the full enjoyment of the wealth they create. In 1884, the national union issued a call for an 8-hour day without a cut in pay, and Milwaukee, with Chicago, became a national center of the movement. May 1st, 1886 was set as the deadline for adoption of the 8-hour day. Some employers, including the city of Milwaukee, agreed, but most resisted, and the result was a general strike that brought the entire community to a standstill. By the morning of May 3rd, half of Milwaukee's workforce had walked off the job. Soon, only one major industry was still running, the Bayview Rolling Mill. On the morning of May 4th, a group of perhaps 1,000 workers, most of them Polish, gathered at St. Stanislaus Church to march on the mill and shut it down. Bayview's laborers, including a large number of Poles, walked out gladly. But skilled workers remained on the job. A delegation went inside to confer with management. Governor Jeremiah Rusk, in the meantime, had arrived in Milwaukee, and Governor Rusk called out the militia. One detachment was posted at E.P. Alice's Reliance Works, a center of conflict the previous day. Another was sent to quell the disturbance in Bayview. They arrived to a shower of sticks, stones, and dead fowl. Tensions eased somewhat when the rolling mill shut down. The marchers headed home, but they made it clear that they intended to return. On the morning of May 5th, 1886, the Polish workers, now 1,500 strong, regrouped at St. Stanislaus Church to resume their march on the mill. Tensions were near the breaking point. Anxious but determined, the strikers marched four abreast behind a banner bearing a clock face set to 8 and the legend 8 hours. The militia was waiting for them. When Governor Rusk was informed by phone that a large crowd was approaching Bayview, he replied, "Very well, sir. Fire on them." One militia captain gave his troops a more specific command.
Pick out your man and kill him.
Onward marched the strikers. At a distance of 200 yards, the militia commander ordered them to halt. They could hardly see the major, much less hear him above their own noise. Reporter on the scene described the reaction.
As if by a common impulse, the crowd fell headlong to the ground, and for a minute, it appeared as though nearly all had been killed or wounded by the first discharge. When the troops ceased firing, all who were uninjured turned and ran pell-mell back to the city, leaving 6 dead or dying in the dusty roadway.
The number of confirmed dead reached at least 5. Including a 12-year-old schoolboy who was playing hooky and a retired mill worker who was watching from his backyard. The Bayview incident was the bloodiest labor disturbance in the state's history. Never before had there been such a dramatic uprising against the given economic order. Never before had one group of Milwaukeeans leveled deadly fire at another. The events in Bayview indicated that something was terribly, horribly wrong. The last word belonged to the workers. On May 23rd, less than 3 weeks after the shootings, nearly 5,000 marched through the streets of Milwaukee, determined to show that they would not be bullied into submission. Robert Schilling, a Knights of Labor leader who spoke after the parade, saw the tragedy as a call to political action.
The poor victims are dead and buried. They shall be revenged, not by making blood flow, not through force. The intelligent citizen has a weapon mightier than the ball or the bayonet, the ballot.
Schilling quickly formed the People's Party of Wisconsin, and workers flocked to its banner. In the fall elections of 1886, the populists captured most county offices, half of Milwaukee's state assembly seats, and a national office as well. A millwright named Henry Smith was the People's Party's candidate for Congress in 1886. Propelled by the votes of his fellow workers, Mr. Smith went to Washington. Labor's victory was short-lived. In the next elections, Republicans and Democrats joined forces against the populists, turning back the third party movement. But a warning had been sounded, a precedent had been set. The Bayview incident had stirred Milwaukee's workers to common action that would lead, in time, to a more durable victory. The events of May 5, 1886 are still remembered. Each year, a diverse group of Milwaukeeans gathers in Bayview to recall a time when people marched and people died for a right that we now take for granted, the right to an eight-hour day.
To the point where I'm going to read the names of the people who lost their lives in 1886. Let us compose ourselves. Frank Conkle. Frank Novarchik. John Marsh. Robert Erdman. Johann Zaska. Martin Jakoviak. Michael Lukowski.
The problems that led to bloodshed in 1886 didn't go away. Hours were still long and wages were still low. But Milwaukee kept growing anyway, fed by a never-ending flow of new immigrants attracted by new industries. Between 1890 and 1910, Milwaukee's population doubled. The city surged past Washington, New Orleans, and Cincinnati to become the 12th largest in America.
A building boom transformed the city's center at the turn of the 20th century. Scores of new landmarks appeared, some raised by industrialists as useful monuments to their success. Meatpackers built Milwaukee's first shopping center, which now anchors the shops of Grand Avenue, as well as gracious apartments with stunning views of the lake. As well as the city's first art gallery. Leather tanners erected fine hotels. And brewers were everywhere. The Pabst family built Milwaukee's first skyscraper, rising all of 13 stories. And a theater that offered some of the finest German language productions outside of Germany. The Schlitz Palm Garden brought the ambiance of a German beer garden indoors. Other landmarks were symbols of corporate might. Two railroad depots served as the grand entrances to Milwaukee in the age of steam. Northwestern Mutual's home office was a monumental expression of financial strength. And there were public buildings of equal stature. The city's first convention center was a Victorian marvel of domes and dormers. When fire brought it down in 1905, the auditorium rose on the same site. Milwaukee County's stately courthouse filled the north half of today's Cathedral Square. The federal building housed the post office as well as courtrooms. A combination library and museum helped to satisfy the public's thirst for knowledge. The crowning glory of all downtown buildings, public or private, was City Hall. It was dedicated in 1895 after endless controversy over site, design, and budget. Milwaukee's first million-dollar building rested on a forest of wooden pilings in a former swamp, but it fast became a civic icon and symbol of pride. City Hall was also an ethnic statement. Its turrets and towers represented a deep bow to Milwaukee's Germanic traditions. New landmarks appeared in the residential districts. As industrial fortunes swelled, architects designed castles for a new class of kings. Grand Avenue, now West Wisconsin Avenue, was lined with mansions from 9th Street all the way to 35th. Highland Boulevard, just a few blocks north, was loaded with families who were, well, loaded. Among them, Pabsts, Millers, Gettlemans, Musingers, Kiekheffers, and Filters. So many wealthy Germans lived on Highland that it was dubbed Sauerkraut Boulevard. On the east side, well-heeled citizens moved up the Lake Bluff from Yankee Hill and lined Prospect Avenue with some of the finest Victorian mansions in the Midwest. Their next stop was North Point, where Pabsts, Fox, Smiths, and Cudahys shared a view of the water tower. The wealthy districts were dwarfed by working-class neighborhoods that sprang up on all sides of the city. Housing for workers, whether Polish flats on the south side or duplexes on the German north side, made Milwaukee one of the most densely populated cities in America. By 1902, only Boston and Baltimore had more people per acre.
There wasn't much of a middle class in turn of the century Milwaukee. A few neighborhoods were built for the movers and shakers, while the rest belonged to the moved and shaken. Those contrasts carried far beyond the city's borders. Between 1890 and 1910, Milwaukee's outward growth produced no fewer than 8 suburbs. They mirrored the wealthy and working class extremes of the city itself, especially along the lakeshore. As always, old neighborhoods set the pattern for new ones.
Bayview provided the model for the southern lakeshore. The old iron mill town was still an industrial powerhouse. In the 1890s, Patrick Cudahy moved his packing plant from the Menominee Valley to a large tract of land south of Bayview. The plant gave rise to a suburb that still bears the founder's name. Just down the lakeshore from Cudahy, South Milwaukee developed an industrial character of its own. The suburb's largest employer for many years was the Bucyrus Steam Shovel Company, later known as Bucyrus Erie. Industry ruled the southern lakeshore, but something quite different was happening on the other side of Milwaukee Bay. In 1894, some of the Gold Coast's younger set began to play a new game on the edge of town, using tomato cans for cups and bandanas for flags. Pasture pool, the skeptics called it. But golf took root. Before long, it was the primary pastime of the Milwaukee Country Club, whose members opened an elegant clubhouse on the Lake Bluff. In 1900, the land around the club was incorporated as East Milwaukee, a suburb known today as Shorewood. Just north was Captain Frederick Pabst's Whitefish Bay Resort, a beer garden that drew throngs of Milwaukeeans coming out by carriage on Lake Drive or by steamer from downtown. In 1892, the land around the resort was incorporated as Whitefish Bay, another community destined for affluence. From sand traps on one side to stockyards on the other, Milwaukee Bay separated two different worlds. There was similar variety in the inland suburbs. Three were industrial: North Milwaukee, West Milwaukee, and West Allis, whose largest taxpayer was Allis Chalmers. The fourth was Wauwatosa, an old Yankee village that had become a gracious bedroom suburb. With a bumper crop of new suburbs and a builder's catalog of new landmarks, Milwaukee was taking on all the earmarks of a thoroughly modern metropolis. Its residents were also embracing the latest technologies. The first telephones went into service in 1877, serving a total of 3 subscribers. By 1896, there were 3,000. Public transit in Milwaukee had always meant cars drawn by horses or mules. In 1890, the West Side Street Railway won a furious race to electrify. One reporter described the cars whizzing down Wells Street like streaks of lightning on roller skates. During the same years, gas lights steadily gave way to electric light. The newfangled bulbs turned night to day in the city's breweries, beer gardens, and music halls. A few Milwaukeeans were exploring an even newer technology. The first automobiles, most of them electrics, were so novel that they were the vehicles of honor in a 1900 civic parade.
Milwaukee was changing, but it still moved to a rhythm all its own, a measured pace that blended large and small, old world and new. Luckily, we have an outstanding visual record of the period. The city had grown large enough to attract some master photographers, people like H.H. Bennett, Sumner Madison, and Robert Taylor. Their images form a Milwaukee family album from the turn of the 20th century. Despite its rank as America's 12th largest city, Milwaukee did have both the feel and the self-image of a much smaller community. A century later, it's still often referred to as a big, small town. An important reason for that character was, and is, the proximity of Chicago.
Milwaukeeans were fully aware that their old rival had won the population race. The nation's second largest city lay just 90 miles south, and there was little hope that Milwaukee could ever catch up to Chicago. Some preferred their hometown's more leisurely pace. Others gave in to a sense of civic inferiority. John Johnston, a downtown banker, voiced a similar complaint way back in 1872.
There is one thing we are deficient in here. We have not the necessary blow and brag. Not only have we not that, but we daily see men standing with their hands in their pockets, whining about Milwaukee being a one-horse town. Such men are not worthy to live here. Milwaukee is not Chicago, but there are a few cities like Chicago. Still, if Milwaukee be not Chicago, Milwaukee has grown at a rate surpassed by but a very limited number of cities in this whole union. Instead of grumbling and whining, let us have some city pride, and let us not listen to any citizen of Milwaukee crying down this, the handsomest and healthiest and happiest city in the West. Let us cultivate the talent of brag. And whether at home or abroad, let us boast of Milwaukee.
Many years later, the city's boosters are still trying to cultivate the talent of brag. Municipal modesty, for better or worse, seems to be as much a part of Milwaukee as bubblers and beer. The truth is that Milwaukee has always had plenty to brag about, both then and now. But there were also reasons for concern.
On a May morning in 1891, the Reverend Theodore Clifton ascended the pulpit of Calvary Presbyterian Church, a prosperous Grand Avenue congregation. Gazing out over his audience, the Reverend launched a scathing indictment of life in the city.
The cities are the cesspools where every form of wickedness concentrates, festers, and propagates itself. Bacchus is worshipped at about 1,300 saloons, 100 altars erected to the worship of God, and 1,300 of them to the worship of the devil. Every peril is here intensified. The perils of wealth, the perils of poverty, the perils of socialism, the perils of intemperance, the perils growing out of the foreign immigration, the perils of ignorance, and the perils of Romanism. No city in the land furnishes richer soil for all the evils of our modern civilization than Milwaukee. Looking over her temples, her palaces, and her hovels, Christ wept. Were he back in the flesh, and were he to approach our city by the lake or land, he would weep again.
The Reverend Mr. Clifton does not sound like someone you'd ask out for a beer. He was a Puritan through and through. But Clifton's sermon reminds us that the good old days exist only in hindsight. At the turn of the 20th century, Milwaukee faced problems that make some of the modern cities pale by comparison. Clifton mentioned class conflict and social unrest, intemperance and poverty. He was only scratching the surface.
Life itself was brutish and short at the turn of the century. Public health standards were appallingly low, and the average Milwaukeean's life expectancy at birth was a paltry 27.6 years. Children under five accounted for the majority of funerals in many neighborhoods. Pollution was part of the problem. Smokestacks and locomotives belched out thick clouds of coal smoke, making the air over Milwaukee dangerous to breathe. But smokestacks were symbols of prosperity. One reporter compared Bayview's iron mill, approvingly, to the volcano Vesuvius spewing smoke over the Bay of Naples. Garbage disposal was just as primitive. There was a time when Milwaukee simply towed its refuse out onto Lake Michigan and pushed it overboard. Problems with water quality were even more difficult to swallow. During the horse and buggy era, tons of manure plopped onto the city streets every day, and the next rain washed it to the nearest river. The result was water pollution of epic proportions. Here's a visitor's description of the Milwaukee River in 1881.
It is a narrow, tortuous stream, hemmed in by the unsightly rear ends of street buildings and all sorts of waste places. It is a currentless and yellowish, murky stream with water like oil and an odor combined of the effluvia of 100 sewers. Nothing could better illustrate the contaminations of city life than this vile and noxious compound here among the wharves.
In 1888, Milwaukee came up with a novel solution to the river nuisance. A tunnel was drilled under the east side, connecting Lake Michigan with the Milwaukee River just below the North Avenue Dam. The city then installed the world's largest water pump, a product of Milwaukee's own E.P. Alice Company. The pump, which still works, literally flushed the putrid river with clean lake water. The result of the flushing tunnel project was a cleaner river, but a dirtier lake. The problem, of course, was that the lake provided Milwaukee's drinking water. Long before anyone could spell cryptosporidium, the city suffered severe epidemics of a malady known, politely, as intestinal flu.
The old flushing station, now a popular coffee shop, was built as a monument to desperation. It solved one problem by creating another that was just as bad. But dirty air and dirty water had their parallels in another part of the city's life, dirty politics.
Milwaukee's new City Hall stood like a tower of civic strength in the heart of the downtown. Its lofty heights were deceptive. In an era of fast dealing and easy virtue, Milwaukee was just as crooked as any big city. The representative figure of the age was Mayor David S. Rose. Elected for the first time in 1898, he held the city's top office for 10 years. Rose was both an eyeful and an earful. Regally attired in Prince Albert coat and striped afternoon trousers, he campaigned for conventions, celebrations, and a live town. "I live to see my people at play and happy," the mayor once said. One of Rose's fondest desires was to put Milwaukee on the map, and the result was a thriving convention business. Visitors did not come to see the library and museum. Under All the Time Rosie, Milwaukee was a wide-open town where gambling dens, all-night saloons, and brothels operated in broad daylight. Prostitution flourished in the very shadow of City Hall. Mayor Rose justified his tolerance with an outlandish biology lesson.
"Men are, and always have been, men. They have their natural passions, which, in the great majority of cases, must and will be gratified. If desires can be fed without turning the animal loose to destroy and ruin young girls, is it not better than to try to prevent what cannot be and never has been prevented?"
The most famous of Milwaukee's madams, Kitty Williams, is immortalized in the Streets of Old Milwaukee exhibit at the Public Museum. Rose had plenty of company in the moral shallows. The common council was every bit as corrupt as the mayor. A council member once leveled this blast at a colleague: "Alderman Richards is of so little importance that he is not worth a cent to anybody to buy him." In the late 1800s, that may have been the worst thing one politician could say about another. Enough was eventually enough. In 1903, nearly 3,000 people jammed Turner Hall for a mass indignation meeting. Speaker after speaker blasted the brigade of grafters that ran both city and county, and they resolved to throw the rascals out. One speaker drew his inspiration from a well-known public works project. "What we want to do is to connect the Flushing Tunnel of politics with the Lake of Clear Conscience and let it run through the putrid river of polluted politics and clean out the stream." The upshot was a round of grand jury investigations led by District Attorney Francis McGovern. By 1906, his juries had returned a grand total of 276 indictments against 83 public officials. David Rose was not among them. The mayor had skillfully covered his tracks. But McGovern blasted him as the self-elected, self-appointed attorney general of crime in this community. Even his staunchest allies began to wonder how their mayor could afford to buy an Arizona copper mine on a $4,000 salary.
Here in City Hall, the politicians sensed a rising tide of reform. Even in the rosiest days of graft and corruption, there had been an undertow of discontent. In the early 1900s, that undertow became a flood. The old line parties, weighed down by scandal, could barely keep their heads above water. Milwaukee decided it was time to try something new. It was time for the socialists.
Socialism was considered a radical philosophy in most American cities, something imported from Europe by men with dense beards and thick accents. In Milwaukee, socialism became a mainstream movement, and that made Milwaukee unique in all the nation. Few cities offered such fertile soil. Milwaukee had legions of industrial workers who had been seeking a political voice ever since the 8-hour uprising of 1886. The city was also a center of German liberal thought. The Turner Halls and Freethinker Societies, started by the famed 48ers, were the socialist movement's intellectual seedbeds. David Rose himself helped the cause. His administration offered a textbook example of how not to govern a city. But socialist theory on its own wouldn't get the job done. The movement needed a Moses, someone who could translate its philosophical fine print into a program and lead the faithful to the promised land. Victor Berger was that Moses. Born in Austria, Berger came to Milwaukee in 1881 and worked variously as a tutor, drama critic, and German teacher. In 1892, he became a full-time socialist, launching a newspaper and leading a political movement. Victor Berger believed devoutly in the cooperative commonwealth of socialist theory, that glorious day when workers would own the means of production. But he believed it wouldn't come until the public was educated to desire it.
How better to educate than by running for office? Berger campaigned for real-world reforms, slum clearance, free health care, better sewage treatment. He saw reforms as steps on the road to true socialism. Some comrades out east began to call the Milwaukee group sewer socialists. But the point was to govern. Like David Rose, Victor Berger wanted to win elections. He developed a strategy called the Milwaukee Idea, a personal union between the socialist movement and the labor movement. Before long, the leaders of both groups were the same people.
The socialists began to field candidates in the 1898 elections. The first results were dismal, but Berger and his comrades were in no hurry. One of the party's most effective tools was the legendary Bundle Brigade. Within 48 hours, an army of Union volunteers could distribute literature to every house in Milwaukee on any issue in any language desired. Year by year, the socialist tide rose. In 1904, the party's ticket, headed by Berger himself, captured 25% of the mayoral vote and 9 seats on the Common Council. David Rose expressed concern.
While we have slept, an enemy, cunning and insidious, has crept into our midst to poison the vitals of our civic body.
Rose called Berger himself a disciple of Satan, whose goal was to substitute the red flag of anarchy for the glorious old emblem of our country. Rose was red-baiting, but the voters didn't bite. The socialists on the council were a welcome change from the usual hacks and grafters. Berger often declared that honesty was the highest quality most politicians could hope to attain. With us, he bragged, this is the first and smallest requirement. Diligent, creative, and incorruptible, the socialists earned the trust of Milwaukee's voters. By 1908, they came within 2,000 votes of unseating David Rose himself. In 1910, finally, victory was complete. For the first and only time in American history, voters of a major city turned their entire government over to socialists. Emil Seidel, a pattern maker by trade, became Milwaukee's mayor. Victor Berger went to Congress. Socialists won a 2/3 majority on the Common Council and more than half the seats on the county board. After years of darkness, the party faithful were certain that a new day had dawned.
The landslide of 1910 was a triumph for the working men and women of Milwaukee. Most of the aldermen who sat in this chamber worked with their hands. Ever since the Bayview shootings of 1886, workers have been searching for their collective voice. Now they had found it. The ethnic industrial character of the city, so obvious for so long, had finally found mature political expression, and Milwaukee has never been the same.
With the socialist triumph of 1910, Milwaukee's ship of state made a 180-degree turn. The city moved from municipally sanctioned vice to a new era of honesty, efficiency, and concern for the working person. Emil Seidel was in command. The new mayor was plain-spoken and passionately committed to social change. He was surrounded by figures of comparable energy. Daniel Webster Hone, a Waukesha-born labor lawyer, was Milwaukee's city attorney. Charles Whitnell, a banker with roots in the greenhouse business, served as city treasurer. Seidel's private secretary and left-hand man was a raw-boned Illinois native who had worked as an organizer for Wisconsin's Socialist Party. Carl Sandburg was destined for fame in a different field, winning Pulitzer Prizes in both poetry and history. Every Saturday afternoon, the mayor convened the entire Socialist Caucus, 50 or 60 people, to chart his administration's course. Seidel's goals were clear.
We wanted our workers to have pure air. We wanted them to have sunshine. We wanted planned homes. We wanted living wages. We wanted recreation for young and old. We wanted vocational education. We wanted a chance for every human being to be strong and live a life of happiness. And we wanted everything that was necessary to give them that. Playgrounds, parks, lakes, beaches, clean creeks and rivers, swimming and wading pools, social centers, reading rooms, clean fun, music, dance, song, and joy for all. That was our Milwaukee movement.
Emil Seidel was reaching for the sky, but he had no intention of bankrupting the city. Milwaukee's socialists, in fact, were every bit as frugal as the average Milwaukee householder, and infinitely more honest than David Rose. Seidel removed so many dead men's names from the polling list that he claimed to have saved the city $500 in annual printing costs. This pragmatic idealist had only 2 years to carry out his program. The Republicans and Democrats had been deeply embarrassed by the socialist sweep, and they were determined not to let it happen again. More concerned about power than principles, they united behind a single candidate in the 1912 mayoral election, Dr. Gerhard Bading. The combined weight of the old-time parties was too much to overcome. Dr. Bading beat Emil Seidel handily. The socialists lost their majorities on both the Common Council and the County Board. And Victor Berger came home from Washington. One high-ranking socialist kept his job, city attorney Daniel Hone. Hone had built his reputation as Fighting Dan, a champion of the working people against the city's entrenched interests. Largely self-made, Hone had left home at the age of 13 and worked his way through school as a cook. Dynamic and determined, he was an obvious candidate for higher office. In 1916, Dan Hone took on the lackluster Gerhard Bading and won, becoming Milwaukee's second socialist mayor. He held the office for the next 24 years. Hone lost none of his spark as Fighting Dan, but the mayor developed a vision of what he repeatedly called a better, bigger, and brighter Milwaukee. What that meant in practice was a devotion to municipal enterprise. Milwaukee socialists believed that public funds should be invested in public housing, public health, a public port, public planning, and public parks, all for the greater good of the greatest number. And they did it with businesslike efficiency. A true Milwaukeean, Hone hated debt, and he worked to put every city department on a pay-as-you-go basis. Although they rarely had a majority on the Common Council, socialists dominated the city's agenda. They were the only group with a program, and their ideas set the tone of public debate. Those ideas included the first city-sponsored housing project in the country. Garden Homes opened on the far north side in 1923. It was a cooperative designed to ease a dire shortage of working-class housing. The cooperative aspect faded years ago, but Garden Homes remains a distinctive Milwaukee neighborhood. Public health was another priority. Milwaukee launched a prevention program that helped double the average citizen's life expectancy between 1900 and 1930. One of the most serious threats to public health was neutralized during the Hone years. In 1925, the Jones Island sewage plant went into operation. Wastewater was not simply dumped, but treated. And sewer socialism took on a literal meaning. In an ultimate act of civic recycling, Milwaukee dried its sewage sludge and sold it as Milorganite, a popular fertilizer. An ambitious landfill project turned the rest of Jones Island into a genuine outer harbor. The docks provided room for a new generation of ships too large to dock in the Milwaukee River. Both the sewage plant and the port were necessary, but they spelled doom for a community soaked in tradition, the Jones Island Fishing Village. One by one, the city bought out the Kashubes and their neighbors. By 1922, there were only six families left on the island. There was less and less room for such improvised settlements in modern Milwaukee. In 1920, the city adopted its first zoning ordinance, ending the days when a tannery could go up next to a townhouse.
Sewage plants and zoning maps were welcome improvements, but one public enterprise outshone all the others. That was parks. When Dan Hoan took office, the city had a definite shortage of public green space. By the time he left, Milwaukee had one of the finest park systems in the world. That system's godfather was another socialist, Charles B. Whitnell. Largely self-taught, generally unpaid, he was the chief architect of Milwaukee's future for an entire generation.
Charles Whitnell pursued public green space with the zeal of a missionary. Nature, he believed, was a necessary antidote to urban life. Contact with creation was vital to the souls of city dwellers. Whitnell could conceive of no higher calling. "We are seeking," he once said, "to conserve not only God's country, but humanity." Whitnell and his co-workers did not have to start from scratch. Beginning in 1890, the city had developed several major tracts of parkland. Lake Park was the East Side's jewel. And Washington Park was the pride of Milwaukee's West Side. Both were designed by the firm of Frederick Law Olmsted, the most prominent and prolific landscape architect in America. Milwaukee Parks housed two of the city's major tourist attractions, the zoo at Washington and the Horticultural Conservatory at Mitchell Park. But open space was scarce and scattered in the early 1900s. What Whitnell hoped to create was a genuine system, one that would bring the influence of nature to bear on every neighborhood. In 1923, he unveiled his master plan. It called for 84 miles of public green space along the county's waterways, with major parks at selected points in the double loop. "Every home," Whitnell wrote, "should feel the environmental influence of natural shores with the essential forest support." With surprisingly few changes, Charlie Whitnell's plan became the template for all future park development. Both the city and the county added aggressively to their holdings, filling in, acre by acre, the blank spots on Whitnell's map. Perhaps the system's crowning glory was Lincoln Memorial Drive. Milwaukee's lakefront, its premier natural resource, had long been off-limits to ordinary citizens. In 1929, after years of landfill activity, the lakefront became a park for all the people. Decades later, Lincoln Memorial is still one of the most spectacular stretches of urban shoreline on the entire Great Lakes.
Lincoln Memorial Drive capped a remarkable period in Milwaukee's history. Amos Seidel, Dan Hoan, Charlie Whitnell, and all the other socialists did much more than restore Milwaukee's good name. They showed the government could be creative, compassionate, and responsive to the needs of the people. As a result, Milwaukee became a national model of sound management and civic virtue. We haven't always measured up, but socialists set the standards that still apply today. But Milwaukee was never a world apart. Even as it became a model of good government, the city was touched by forces that made it more like every other place. Some of those forces developed inside America's borders. Others rose on the far side of the ocean.
As the 20th century wore on, the world became both a smaller and a more violent place. In 1914, tensions that had been simmering in Europe for decades erupted into full-scale war. New weapons, from submarines to mustard gas, made World War I the deadliest conflict in history up to that time. Milwaukeeans felt worlds away from the fighting at first. The United States was officially at peace, and life went on much as it had before. President Woodrow Wilson declared his nation neutral in fact as well as in name. But most Americans favored England, France, and their allies. For many Milwaukeeans, Germany and Austria were the home team, and Kaiser Wilhelm, the German emperor, was a hero. In 1916, the Milwaukee Auditorium was the scene of a week-long bazaar for the relief of German and Austrian war sufferers. The displays, raffles, and free-flowing beer attracted 175,000 people, nearly half the city's population. The Milwaukee Journal declared the bazaar the biggest thing ever attempted in Milwaukee. Only a year later, such open sympathy for the Germans would have seemed treasonous. Preparedness parades demonstrated the shift in America's mood. On April 6, 1917, the United States finally jumped into the conflict. The world, proclaimed President Wilson, must be made safe for democracy. The declaration of war had an electric impact on Milwaukee. Thousands of young men left home to fight the enemy over there. Milwaukee's own Billy Mitchell became one of the heroes. The grandson of pioneer tycoon Alexander Mitchell was placed in charge of the entire Allied Air Service, and he earned a promotion to general. Workers at home did their part for the war effort. Milwaukee's industrial output more than doubled during the conflict, and local firms turned out everything from ship gears to chipped beef. With manpower in short supply, woman power helped to make up the difference. War was good for business, but the economic boom proved to be an ethnic catastrophe. The most German city in America found itself in an all-out war with the Vaterland, and ties to the ancestral culture faded fast. As the propaganda machine kicked into high gear, Kaiser Bill was demonized as a butcher, and all Germans as bloody Huns. As the war dragged on in the trenches of Europe, the anti-German agitation at home degenerated into simple hysteria. Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms were banned from the concert stage. The German-English Academy was rechristened Milwaukee University School. A number of Schneiders and Schmidts became Taylors and Smiths. Enrollment in the public school's German classes dropped from 30,000 to a mere 400. Adults who tried to speak German in public were subjected to ridicule. The Deutscher Club, housed in Alexander Mitchell's old mansion, changed its name to the Wisconsin Club. Even the humblest foods were not spared by an ethnic cleansing. Sauerkraut was renamed Liberty Cabbage, and hamburger became Salisbury Steak. World War I was just as hard on Milwaukee's socialists. In 1917, the National Party adopted a strident anti-war platform. Almost instantly, the party faded to obscurity, everywhere but its stronghold on Lake Michigan. Dan Hone kept getting elected mayor. He faithfully discharged his duties to support the war effort, but he also found a novel application for his socialist principles. When Hone detected wartime profiteering in local grocery stores, he sold carloads of government surplus food to the public at cost. Congressman Victor Berger had a harder time. When his newspaper, the Milwaukee Leader, ran a series of anti-war editorials, federal officials banned it from the U.S. mails. They next went after Berger himself. In 1918, he was convicted of sedition for his editorial stands. Milwaukee voters were unmoved. They sent Berger back to Congress even after his trial. When the House refused to seat him, they elected him again by an even wider margin. World War I finally ended in November 1918 with a resounding victory for the Allies and a sigh of relief for the Socialists. Milwaukeeans, including German Milwaukeeans, shared in the general jubilation. But the city's anti-German fever refused to break. When the Pabst Theater tried to stage a German-language production 1 year after the war, super patriots aimed a cannon at the landmark and threatened to literally bring down the house. The show did not go on.
The anti-German witch hunt was almost laughable, but only in hindsight. Its impact on the city was deadly serious. Milwaukee had once been known as the German Athens, the cultural capital of German America. World War I brought those days to a quick and inglorious end. The entire community felt the loss. German art, German theater, and German music had long defined the city's high culture. Misplaced patriotism crippled them all, and Milwaukee's cultural progress was set back for decades. But there were still more losses to come.
Liquid refreshment had always been easy to find in Milwaukee. Before 1920, the city was the home of 9 breweries, 2,000 saloons, and a legendary public thirst. Prohibition ended all that. The ban on alcohol went into effect on July 1st, 1919, and the spigots were officially closed for 14 long years. A way of life had come to an end. Prohibition created special problems for the beer capital of America. Thousands of Milwaukeeans lost their jobs, and local breweries were forced into some rather bizarre lines of business. Gettleman made snowplows designed by the founder's son. Pabst turned out processed cheese using milk supplied by the family's prize-winning dairy herds. Schlitz went into the candy business, producing a chocolate bar named for the Eline family that owned the brewery. Public support for Prohibition was practically non-existent in Milwaukee. The Great Experiment was widely considered an economic and social disaster. But Milwaukee never went dry. Dan Hone was a realist. If I had the whole United States Army, the mayor declared, I could not prevent illegal drinking. Prohibition is a big joke. The soft drink parlors listed in the city directory sold much more than strawberry phosphates. Suppliers of home brew and bathtub gin cropped up everywhere, and authorities couldn't begin to keep up with them. Hardware stores did a brisk business in build-it-yourself stills.
That's my grandfather, John Goethe, standing in front of the store. He and his wife, Mary, ran Goethe Hardware right here on 32nd and Lincoln for 50 years. When the store finally closed in 1964, there was an ample supply of copper kettles and metal tubing in the basement. Prohibition was in some ways the mildest of the blows that fell on Milwaukee during and after World War I. Before the war, Milwaukee had been America's capital of Germanism, socialism, and beer. Those were its hallmarks, the things that set the city apart. By 1920, Germans were on the run, socialists were endangered, and beer was illegal. Those losses made Milwaukee feel and act more like other American cities. Dan Hone had always promised what he called a better, bigger, and brighter Milwaukee. In the wake of World War I, it was blander as well. We call them. The 1920s are usually painted as a decade of gin-soaked flappers and gun-toting gangsters, a time when Americans flocked to wild speakeasies and grand movie palaces, including this one, Milwaukee's own Oriental Theater. The reality, as always, is more complex. The 20s were a decade of roaring prosperity, but they were also a time of unusual stress. There were new pressures to conform, new groups to assimilate, and entirely new forms of popular culture. Milwaukee changed with the nation. By the time the decade ended, the city was emerging in its modern form.
The echoes of World War I were heard well into the 1920s. The conflict had not ushered in a golden age of global democracy. Americans were horrified by the war's brutality and repelled by the communists' rise to power in Russia. The United States soon lost its appetite for foreign entanglements. Congress rejected the League of Nations, and the country as a whole turned decisively inward. America's growing isolationism soon reached newcomers on its own shores. There was widespread agreement that the so-called new immigrants in the melting pot simply weren't melting fast enough. Poles, Italians, Greeks, Jews, and others seemed intent on preserving their old customs and cultures. Some would-be reformers tried to replace the melting pot with a pressure cooker. Americanization programs, many based in the workplace, offered hurry-up lessons in the English language and American civics. There were uglier attempts to force conformity. Milwaukee, like most northern cities, supported an active Ku Klux Klan chapter in the 1920s. Its members had a long list of hates: blacks, Catholics, Jews, immigrants, and anyone else who wasn't 100% American. Dan Hone issued a clear warning to what he called the Hoods and Nighties set. Milwaukee will become the hottest place this side of hell if any of the Klan pounce upon one of our citizens, whether he be black or white, red or yellow, Jew or Gentile, Catholic or Protestant. The entire nation was suffering an outbreak of nativism, a belief that America belonged only to those who were born here, even if their own ancestors were immigrants. The epidemic finally infected Congress itself. In the 1920s, the United States adopted quota laws that ended free immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. The Statue of Liberty had long welcomed newcomers to American shores. "Give me your tired, your poor," read the poem at her base. "Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." In the 1920s, the door was slammed shut. No sooner had free emigration from Europe ended than an industrial boom began. The 20s started to roar in earnest, and Milwaukee's role as machine shop of the world expanded steadily. A number of manufacturers became the largest in their fields. Alice Chalmers led the nation in heavy machinery, from ore crushers to electric turbines. Harnischweger was number one in cranes and hoists, the same spot held by Harley-Davidson in motorcycles, and the Bucyrus Company in steam shovels, including some that dug the Panama Canal. A.O. Smith was the largest in automobile frames, Johnson Controls in temperature regulators, and Cutler Hammer in electrical controls, with more turned out by Allen Bradley and Square D. Evinrude dominated the market for outboard motors. Falk, large-scale industrial gears. Nordberg, mine hoists. And Caring, cement machinery. The list of America's largest included a few surprises, including enamelware, represented by the National Enameling and Stamping Company, whose initials spelled NESCO. The company's ubiquitous roasters made thousands of church suppers possible. Milwaukee was also the nation's leading producer of silk hosiery, with Phoenix and Holeproof at the head of the pack. Few cities in America were even half as productive. Milwaukee County's industrial output approached $1 billion a year in the 1920s, and manufacturing provided jobs for well over half the workforce. That workforce grew despite the artificially imposed labor shortage. When one door closes, another opens. The ban on European immigration cleared the way for workers who were already on American soil. Milwaukee's black population swelled from fewer than 1,000 in 1910 to more than 7,500 in 1930. Many were recruited by labor agents who roamed the South in search of workers. The newest Milwaukeeans were a small part of the Great Migration that brought 1 million African Americans from the rural South to the urban North. They were fleeing the grinding poverty of the sharecropper's life, and they were seeking opportunity. What they found was hard work and housing discrimination. Nearly every African American lived in a section of the North Side known as Bronzeville. But there, they developed all the earmarks of a genuine community. Walnut Street became Bronzeville's downtown. During the Jazz Age, some of the best music in Milwaukee was heard in the nightclubs on Walnut. Old institutions prospered, especially churches. St. Mark AME and Calvary Baptist, the pioneer congregations, remained cornerstones. They were joined by St. Benedict the Moor, a Catholic mission, and two Baptist churches, Greater Galilee and Mount Zion. St. Benedict's was best known for its boarding school, whose alumni included comedian Red Fox and Chicago Mayor Harold Washington. New institutions sprang up, a local chapter of the NAACP, the Wisconsin Enterprise newspaper, and the Milwaukee Urban League. In 1925, Wilbur Halyard opened Columbia Building and Loan, the black community's first financial institution. Although its growth was dramatic, Milwaukee's African-American community remained relatively small. Chicago, by contrast, was a primary destination for northbound newcomers. In 1930, African-Americans made up 7% of Chicago's population, but only 1.3% of Milwaukee's. That late start would affect the community for years to come. Despite their late start and small numbers, the city's African Americans developed a rich and comprehensive community life. Latinos settled in Milwaukee at the same time for the same reason. Labor agents traveling to the Southwest or into Mexico itself offered free passage to Milwaukee. Males came first. Families followed. Los Primeros, the pioneers, went to work for the Pfister and Vogel Tannery in Walker's Point. Nearly 100 young men came north in 1920, sleeping on cots in a tannery building. As nearby industries hired more Latinos, a residential enclave developed on the multi-ethnic near south side. Miguel Sevilla was one of the newcomers. In 1926, he arrived from the state of Michoacán in west central Mexico. Sevilla found a job at the Harnischfeger Company and a home in Walker's Point. By the late 1920s, there were perhaps 4,000 Mexican residents in the city, enough to form the largest Spanish-speaking community in the entire state. Some found more than a new home. Miguel Sevilla fell in love with a young Polish woman named Anna Robel. The Mexican newcomer and the Polish immigrant's daughter were soon married, uniting what are still the two major ethnic backgrounds on Milwaukee's south side. Other signs of permanence emerged in the 20s, including a dramatic club, a newspaper, mutual aid societies, and a group that celebrated Mexican Independence Day for the first time in 1930. In 1926, Milwaukee's Mexicans established the Mission of Our Lady of Guadalupe in a storefront on South Fifth Street. Like so many other newcomers, they made the place of worship their anchor of community. Our Lady of Guadalupe congregation later moved to an old telephone exchange in Walker's Point, and then merged into Holy Trinity Church, the Southside's original German parish.
Milwaukee was no longer Europe once removed after World War I. It had always been a city of newcomers, but now the newcomers had roots in the New World. There was nothing glamorous about their lives here. African Americans and Latinos usually took the dirtiest jobs at the lowest wages. But their rise marked a major turn in Milwaukee's history, a turn toward the remarkable diversity of the present. There were other foreshadowings of modern Milwaukee. New tastes, new trends, and new technologies swept the entire nation, and Milwaukee changed accordingly. As mass society overran local culture, the city entered the American mainstream.
One sure sign of change was the city's outward expansion. In the runaway prosperity of the 20s, Milwaukee developed a genuine middle class. and its members built neighborhoods of their own on the city's fringe. Sherman Park on the northwest side was the quintessential 20s neighborhood. Real estate developers turned scores of farms into subdivisions and promoted them with gusto. The result was a new kind of urban community. Sherman Park's regular setbacks and orderly streetscapes reflected the influence of zoning, a 1920s innovation. Neighborhood parks underscored Milwaukee's commitment to public green space. New schools matched the upwardly mobile aspirations of new residents. Washington High School, which opened in 1915, was among the finest in the city. A new house type appeared, the Milwaukee bungalow. Like the Polish flat and the duplex of earlier decades, the sturdy bungalow was distinctly Milwaukee, and it became the signature house of the 1920s in Sherman Park and elsewhere. Behind each bungalow was another new building type, the garage. Sherman Park was one of the first neighborhoods whose residents commuted to work by automobile. Automobiles had been a rich man's toy in the early 1900s, but their numbers soared as prices dropped. In 1910, there was only one car for every 84 families in Wisconsin. In 1920, there was one for every two. And in 1930, the ratio was 1 to 1. In less than 20 years, a luxury became a necessity. For families in Sherman Park and similar neighborhoods, both the bungalow and the automobile were standard equipment. Inside those homes, a brave new world was waiting. America became a full-fledged mass market in the 20s, flooded with mass-produced goods, promoted by mass advertising. Kitchens and workshops filled up with labor-saving appliances. It also became an electric society. In 1910, only 10% of Milwaukee's households had electric power. By 1927, the proportion had swelled to a stunning 97%. The massive Lakeside Power Plant was built to keep pace with the region's appetite for energy. It provided the power for a consumer revolution. New forms of entertainment appeared. By decade's end, most Milwaukee households owned radios. The city's first radio station was WAAK, a 100-watt wonder that began to broadcast from Gimbel's department store in 1922. National networks soon dominated the airwaves, and countless families huddled around the console to hear the latest installments of the Grand Old Opry, Amos and Andy, and the A&P Gypsies.
The Amos and Andy Show, transcribed.
Radio gave families a reason to stay home, but another form of mass entertainment brought them out in droves, the motion picture. By 1929, Milwaukee had a total of 94 movie theaters, from the Alhambra to the Zenith. Many were movie palaces, an outlandishly original form of architecture that transported viewers to another world.
The 1920s were indeed a different world. They introduced new tensions, new neighbors, and they carried Milwaukee even deeper into the broad, forgetful waters of mass society. The 20s were a noisy, tumultuous decade, but soon enough things would be quiet, all too quiet.
Production of The Making of Milwaukee is made possible with grants from Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Halbert and Alice Kadish Fund, Paddock Fund, Lidke Smith Fund, Otto Borchard Family Fund, Catherine and Walter Lindsay Fund, Lined and Harry Bradley Foundation, Kepin Gerlach Foundation, Faye Macbeth Foundation, Northwestern Mutual Foundation, David and Julia Eline Charitable Foundation, We Energies, Joseph and Vera Zilber Foundation, Polybill Foundation, Douglas and Eleanor Seaman Trust, C.G. Schmidt, and by the MPTV Friends.